Let's start. So, I think we So we've been through the roofline model and the last time, and this essentially closes the introduction to computer to the basics of computer architecture. Hello. To the to basics of computer architecture. Do you still have questions regarding the first part? Oh, sorry. No? Okay. So today the second part starts with, so apologies for the old slides. So this is these are the old slides from 2 years ago now. I didn't get around to actually update them to the new theme, to the new Beamer template, but they are still accurate. So what we are going to do is essentially, oh, sorry, today discuss the motivation for multi-core processors, okay? So the second part was dubbed the road to exascale, right? And one of the most important component there are the CPUs, right? So what we discussed in the first part was essentially how more or less a single core, a single CPU core operates, right? So the question is, what are the challenges in the processor designs? What do we have to do? What are the developments, and how do certain physical aspects, etc., play into the design of multi-core of general processors, and what are the trends, and where do we go to? So that's why I'm trying to motivate why multi-core processors are needed. And I don't know if anyone ever heard of Moore's Law. No? Yeah? Okay. Little bit. So Moore was one of the co-founders of Intel, okay, and it's not really a law, it's more an observation, okay. And the observation he had in 1965 was that the available transistors on a chips double every year or every 2 years, okay. So between 18 to 24 months, the number of transistors here in green double every 18 to 24 months, right? So this is for the Intel processor lines, right? And so it's not a physical law in that sense. It's more the observation from a economic and technical perspective, right? So it's not really that the advances in physics or in material sciences allow us to double the available transistors every 2 years, but actually the economic aspects, okay? Since so most of the considerations in modern processor designs are a trade-off between costs and actual performance increases, okay? So one of the biggest challenges is really the manufacturing process to actually manufacture such a chip. So, do you know what a wafer is, or how approximately a CPU gets manufactured? Yes, no? Okay. So, the way it goes is that you have what's called a wafer, okay? And a wafer is a disc-like thing where silicon is on top, right? And what's so it's usually a disc, right? So obviously round, right? So this is a circle, perfect circle. And it's a few centimeters in diameter, right? And what's happening during... Hi, please come in. More to come?
From Nuremberg.
From Nuremberg, oh god. Lots of traffic?
Yeah, the train was delayed a little bit.
Okay. Okay. Happens. Do more people come, or are you the only ones coming from Nuremberg? Okay. Right. So manufacturing of processes. So you have this this wafer, which is silicon, and what happens when you when a so-called fabric actually manufactures those chips is that on this wafer you have a few hundred processes manufactured in one step, right? So the way how it's done is usually that similar to taking a photograph, right? You burn the structure of your transistors into the silicon, right? So burning is a little wrong there, but more or less with photonic beams with lasers, you actually create the transistor structures over and over again, right? So as said, this wafer is probably I think about 10 centimeters in diameter or something like that, and you try to put on structures in the nanometer scale onto that, right? So pretty complicated. And of course, the higher density, the lower the structures become, the higher the failure rate is, right? So usually the yield for a processor, the yield of a fabric, so the actual good processes that come out of the manufacturing line is about 10%, right? So that's pretty low. Right. So, and the higher the technology advances, the more failures you actually get. Right. And this is multiple reasons. Right. The silicon might not be as pure as wanted. Right. Then you have certain mechanical issues and physical issues you can't really control. Right. And what you see usually is that you just have a spot where the produced silicon is faulty, right? So you have to throw it away. And as technology advances, the manufacturing process, of course, gets better and better, right? So it's more feasible to put more transistors with a lower structural length on such a wafer. So it's economically feasible to double the transistor on a chip every 2 years. Okay, so that's more or less the meaning behind it. It's not that it's physical limitations. Well, it's also, so nowadays it's becoming also physical limitations, but back in 1965 it was definitely not physical limitations, but more the technological / economical limitations in the manufacturing process. Okay, so what we also see here on this is that the clock speed of the processors is saturating, right? As well as the power consumption and the performance per clock, obviously, right? So that's one of the most important observations that we see for modern processors, right? Okay. So that's just something to keep at the back of your head at the moment. Okay. So what we also see is that what you see on this graph, so the red line here is the node name, which is if you see marketing slides or announcement of new processor technologies, you usually hear something like this new processor is manufactured with 14 nanometers. Right, this is the node name, right? So it goes continuously down and starts to saturate eventually, right? At the moment we are at 7 nanometers for some chips, okay? which is actually quite small, right? And the other lines is the gate length, right? If you look at a transistor, does anyone approximately know how transistors are built? So, No. So it's more or less. So you have this NP dotting, kind of. So it's something like this. I don't remember exactly where the N and P's etc. comes from, but what you have are essentially two sides, right? So where the current flows in that direction, and if the transistor is turned off, right? This has high resistance, so there's no current flowing through it, right? And if you apply voltage here, right, then the current is actually able to flow through the transistor. So it's just a gate build of transistors, and the gate length then is this one here, right? So the distance between the two parts of the switch, which are insulated or which are supposed to be insulated once the transistor is turned off. Okay. Right. And you see that this gate length is more or less always kind of constant, right? Just a matter of time. So it's actually very complicated in how we look at Moore's law. Okay, but the main message here is that the transistors shrink with every new generation, and they usually consume less power when they're actually being switched. Okay, so what we had in the past is that the higher the transistor performance, the higher frequency we can get, right? This means that the higher transistor performance means that we can switch them faster. Okay, so the electrons take a certain amount of time to travel from here to here, right? So that limits our performance, which is essentially limiting the frequency that we can get out of the processor, right? And usually the performance of the transistor is usually directly related with the size of the transistor. So that means that the higher transistor performance we get, we also get smaller transistors, which means that we get a higher density of transistors on our chip, which means that we can come up with more complex architectures, which use more transistors, which are used to build up the logic and the memory, etc. Right? And usually, what comes along with that is that the energy dissipation, the energy that's being used when doing the switch, so it's not frictionless or anything, there's some energy loss there, becomes lower and lower, and that means that the heat dissipation on our chip stays within certain limits. Okay, so nowadays we really have billions of transistors on a single chip, right? So the chips with the largest transistor counts are GPUs usually, which have in the range of, I think, 40 billion transistors at the moment. So lots and lots of transistors, right? And it's getting more and more with every new generation, right? But the problem is that we are closing in on fundamental barriers within the range. Sorry. Within the laws of physics, right? So eventually, when we get smaller and smaller, we reach the size of an atom, right? Of an atom in the silicon. And that's becoming really a problem, because then we enter the laws of quantum mechanics. So we have things like tunnel effects, etc., etc. We also get more and more problems with heat dissipation. Sorry, my apologies. So, if we look at the performance advancements in from the 1980s to the late to the early 2000s, we see that the biggest performance improvements was actually due to adding more and more complex features to the processor, right? Even though we increased the frequency of those processors, almost linearly, the biggest performance improvement, so this is a logarithmic scale, the biggest performance improvement really was due to architectural improvements. Okay? So here we have pipelining, integration of cache, we have superscalar instructions, we have speculative out-of-order execution, the vector intrinsics, level 2 cache with the full frequency of the processor, and then we got hyper-threading, right? But still, the easiest way to get more performance is actually by just scaling the frequency, right? So this was considered as the free lunch, right? So this is also what mostly drove the computer industry, right? What you could expect by buying a new processor is you have some application, you buy a new processor, your application automatically improves the performance with the new processor just by scaling the frequency, right? Also known as free lunch. Right, so the pressure was put to the electrical engineers and the physicists to come up with newer technology, right? So, right. But increasing the clock frequency of the processor actually touches technological limits, okay? So what we have here is the power consumptions of processors in Watt. And what you see here is that we have this thermal danger zone, right, where the processor would just melt down. What you see is that the newer processors, really, if you increase the clock frequency, you get closer and closer to this thermal danger zone, right? So if you actually look at your processor, at the heat dissemination that's actually being produced at the processor, if you compare it to, for example, your regular stove, right, then the density of this heat is actually way higher than what you have on the stove, right? So if you would put 10 processors next to each other, you could actually boil water on top of it, right? That's how hot they get, right? So for that reason, we can't really increase the frequency anymore. So the answer to that is multi-core architectures, okay? That means that we have multiple processor cores which execute instructions simultaneously on one of those dies that are being produced. Right, and so here again is an approximation of the power dissemination of a chip, right? And what we see is that that by driving up the frequency, we essentially multiply the quadratic voltage that's being supplied to our processes with the frequency, right? So it just costs too much energy, right? And also the other problem is that the architectural improvements of today's processes is, well, being exhausted, right? So for example, the branch prediction. So if we have a branch, if you have an if condition, for example, and we want to predict in the processor if the condition is true or false, right? Which is done in modern processes, the hit rate is on average 95%, right? So 95% of the time, the processor actually predicts the which branch it should take correctly, right? So it's unlikely that it's going to get higher than that, right? So more performance is only viable via true performance improvements. Okay, so and here again is a quote from Wyatt Gibbs, who says that smaller transistors and much higher clock speed, which drove the industry in former times, is now more or less over. That means that the free lunch for the consumer, for the customer, is over as well, right? So what do we get out of multiple cores? So what we get essentially is that we get a more even heat distribution on the chip, right? So if we look at a CPU with one core, so looking at one core, we have somewhere the ALU, okay, which is busy all the time, right? Hopefully all the time. That means that the transistors switch with every frequency. This means that at this spot we get a spot of high heat dissipation, right? And by increasing the size of the ALU, the complexity of the ALU, means that we just increase the spot, right? And it might mean that we have some spot here in the ALU, some spot here and here, right? So we have some uneven heat distribution. Okay. If we, however, on the same die space, approximately, add multiple cores, right, we get the spots of the heat dissipation evenly distributed across the chip, right? The other nice thing is, which is a little in contradiction to what's said earlier, that some cores can be switched off or clocked down to lower speeds if they are unused, right? So that means that if we have an application that only uses one core, we can switch off the others, which essentially reduces the overall power consumption, right? And the other nice thing is that they are relatively simple to produce, right? Of course, and the additional cores only increase the cooling effort linearly, okay? So simple to produce is more or less we have the same structure here, 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 and here, right? And if I have the right manufacturing processes, actually, it doesn't really matter if I put one CPU here and then distribute it here, or just have multiple CPUs, right? And this fights the problem that the previous architectural measures are almost exhausted. Okay, so for that reason, we have the multi-core revolution. At this point in time, parallel computing is not anymore a academic niche, right? So even your phones have between 4 and 8 cores, right? I think the new iPhone has 8 cores, I believe, plus a digital signal processor for encoding and decoding videos, plus a processor for the mobile communication, and so on, and a GPU, and so on and so forth, right? So you have multiple processor units, even on the small device as you have on the smartphone. So parallel computing really entered the mainstream. And what we have is homogeneous and heterogeneous multi-core processors. So the most prominent ones are, the chips from Intel and AMD with the Ryzen processor, the chips from Sun, the Spark chips, IBM with the power chips, and obviously ARM, which delivers the mobile market nowadays. So ARM is not really a manufacturer. They only actually produce the design and then license the design so that companies like Apple or Samsung or whoever can license this design and use those building blocks that are laid out in the design to actually produce their processes, right? The other developments are in the direction of heterogeneous processes. That means that we have different kind of cores on a single chip, right? So in that sense, the chip that you have on your in your smartphone is actually a heterogeneous processor because it has not only the ARM main CPU but also various other processors on top of it. Right? And the number of cores that we see in those systems, so in the homogeneous ones, are usually nowadays between 1 and around 16, something like that, on a single CPU. And for the GPUs and the other ones, we see the development going to so-called many-core processors. The distinction between multi-core and many-core isn't really clear. When we talk about multi-core, we usually mean the regular big cores that we have on the Intel processors or the AMD processors or IBM or even ARM processors. And when we talk about many-core processors, we usually talk about hundreds or even more cores that are on the single chips that are usually much, much smaller in their design than their big counterparts, right? So in that sense, a GPU nowadays can also be counted as a many-core processor. Okay, so the latest NVIDIA GPU, so the marketing slides for the NVIDIA GPU says that they have around 4,000 cores on their chip. Okay, we'll see what's behind that eventually. Okay. So the trend of the last years, this is a little outdated, unfortunately. So what we had 17 years back is 130 nanometer technology. Right? What you can buy today off the shelf is a 14 nanometer structure. Right? This is a pretty huge, this is one order of magnitude better in less than 20 years. Right? So that's pretty nice. So, as said, we have 100 billions of transistors on approximately 300 millimeter chip die. And what's interesting here is that around 1.5 billion is just for the logic, and the rest of the transistors are used for the caching. Okay, so that's quite intense. The problem is that. So we have 1.5 billion logic transistors for the logic, and then we jump up to also include the caching. Right? So what should we do with those with this huge amount of transistors, right? So the trend that we see is that we have predominantly still a few large processor cores, which are between 20 to 100 millions of logic transistors and a large common cache, right? And the reason for that is essentially Pollack's rule, okay? Which states that the increase of performance is directly proportional to the square root of the increase of complexity, okay? This means that if we double the transistors in the processor, which increases the complexity, right? We get about 40% more performance out of it, okay, approximately. So if we look at the integer computing performance versus the area for new microarchitectures, right? So the performance is directly proportional to the square root of the area, which is again the complexity, right? We see that we eventually hit this sweet spot where it just isn't sellable anymore. That we invest in doubling the area or the complexity of the chip, right? Because the performance gains aren't that big anymore, right? So doubling of a single core leads to double-sized monolithic single core processors, which only yield about 40% increase of performance, right? But going from a single core to dual core gives us about 70 to 80% performance increase, right? The other benefits are, of course, that the energy consumption is our primary concern, I guess. And on multi-cores, we can switch single cores off. A single core can be operated with an optimum power supply and frequency. And the computing load can be distributed more regular over the entire chip area. That means that we have less hotspots over the die, and we can also operate the multiple cores at a lower frequency. Yeah.
Doesn't it actually mean that Pollack's rule doesn't apply anymore? Because we double the transistor count and get 70 to 80 performance increase instead of the stated 40% performance increase.
We double the transistor count, but we don't double the complexity, right? Because we do double the complexity in some sense, of course, but let's take this four core example, right? If we double the amount of transistors, right, what we can do is, well, we can just mirror what we have here. So we doubled the amount of transistors, right? And doubled the amount of cores. The complexity of a single core isn't increased.
So complexity for you isn't the complexity of the chip design, but the complexity of the components inside the chip.
The complexity is pushed towards the how the different cores communicate with each other. Right.
Because from a chip designer's point of view, it is double as complicated. You have double as many cores on the chip because you have to layer and stuff, and it's really hard. But hence my asking for definition. So we speak about the same thing.
Yeah. So yes, the complexity is still increased, right? Layouting, the on-chip communication, and so on, right? So we don't, by doubling the amount of cores, we don't immediately get a 2x performance improvement, right? So because we still do have the issue of how they communicate with each other, which is parts of layout problem, the communication is always a problem, right? The on-chip network that we need to supply gets more and more complex. So it's not that easy, but it's a rough rule, right? It's just the motivation, more or less. And also, some people also say that it's a little bit unfair that the chip designers went from those architectural improvements that gave us programmers the free lunch, essentially, where we buy the new processor generation, we just increase the performance of our application, which is not the case anymore, right? Not necessarily. Because now we kind of have to use all those cores that are available to actually benefit from the new processor generation, right? More or less. I mean, if you look at the desktop CPU market, right, which is still kind of the biggest driver, at least for Intel, or even even for ARM, you don't really see a big increase in the number of cores, right? I mean, the ARM processors that are being built into the mobile phones, they are between 2 and 8 cores, right? But that has been since, I don't know, 5 years or so, right? So the number of cores on those chips don't really increase that much. Same on the desktop area, right? Where you have between 2 and 8 cores, usually, right? Unless you buy one of those new AMD CPUs, right, which now actually really are pushing the boundary of number of cores on the desktop market, right? But now the programmer actually has to invest into the program to actually benefit from those new architectures, right? So the complexity is shifted between different parts, as always, right? Right, so the question now comes is, if we stay within our 300 millimeter die for a 2-core die, right? And we, and we just increase the transistor performance, right? What we see is that eventually, stay within our 2-core die. Increase the transistor performance, so that means that we can increase the frequency. We also increase the total power consumption, okay? Which is again, as I said, our biggest concern here, right? So if we just increase the frequency and frequency and frequency, we essentially hit 1,000 watts of power consumption, which is not going to happen anytime soon, right? So we actually need to reduce our power supply even more. Or we should reduce our power supply even more, right? So just staying at the same core count isn't going to help us much when we want to increase the performance. Okay, so that means that we really have to go beyond multi-core towards many-core. That's essentially by applying inversely Pollock's rule, right? So the goal is to preserve the energy consumption, but increase the number of cores, right? So the example is if we have 1 billion of transistors, we can build 10 cores with 100 millions, 100 cores with 10 millions, or 1,000 cores with 1 million transistors, right? And you see that the complexity really decreases, right? So by adding more and more cores, we actually gain more and more performance when applying Pollock's rule, right? This completely leaves out the problem that you hinted at, right? The complexity in layouting, communication, and so on, right? So the nice thing is when going towards more multi-core designs is that the power consumption per core, per added core decreases, is a linear function, all right? And the throughput that we get approximately with a larger number of cores is also increasing and increasing. And by having more cores on one chip, we actually get more and more flexibility, right? So that means that the cores on our chip don't necessarily need to be homogeneous, but can also be heterogeneous, right? So what we see in laptop processors or even on phones, as I noted already, is that we get graphic cores combined with a single core, that we get general purpose with special purpose chips, and they of course have to be connected with an on-die connection network, right? So special purpose core could mean something for artificial intelligence, right? For deep learning, and we've seen that being added to almost all CPU designs, right? So for example, NVIDIA is putting their tensor cores on their GPUs, right, which is a specialized unit that is used for deep learning stuff. And we see cryptographic functions on processors, etc. Okay. So the other problem, however, is that we still have to kind of deal with the thing called Amdahl's law. Okay, and Amdahl essentially said that the increase of the speed up that we gain from parallelly executing a program is limited by the serial fraction of a program, right? So the parallel speed up is essentially one divided by the serial portion of our code plus the parallel portion, so one minus the serial portion is the parallel portion divided by the number of cores, right? And what you see is that depending on how many on how big the serial portion of our code is, we approach a limit rather quickly, right? So with a serial portion of 20%, we get a maximum speed up of around 4, even when the number of cores increases, right? So this is the linear line, I think, right? So this suggests that even if we increase the number of cores, right, we are somehow limited. So is this really worth it, right? So what do we actually gain from getting more and more performance, more and more cores, right? The answer to the problem is, of course, that we can increase the parallel section of our programs almost arbitrarily, right? So in the sense of scientific computing, if we have larger and larger problem sizes, right, we usually increase the parallel fraction of our code significantly. So that means that what we hope to see is that the serial portion of the code stays constant, right, while the parallel portion of the code is scaling with our problem sizes, right? That means if you remember the introduction lecture, the first lecture where we talked about the use cases for supercomputers, right? For example, for the climate simulation, when we start with a single core, right? And the single core is able to calculate the weather of, say, Erlangen on a 10 square kilometer grid, right? in a reasonable amount of time, right? By increasing the number of cores, we are able to perform some of those operations in parallel, right? By not increasing the problem size, our serial portion eventually dominates, right? So we run into Amdahl's law eventually. However, if we increase the problem size, let's say instead of a granularity of 10 square kilometer, we now use a granularity of 1 square kilometer, right? We are able to utilize our parallel system more and more, right? Just as an example. The other example is that not all applications really require a serial fraction. So, for example, if we do parameter studies, we can just send off as many parameter studies as we want, right? And those can execute more or less independently, right? So that means that we are able to increase the parallel section arbitrarily without any serial portion of the code. And this is sometimes called inherently parallel or embarrassingly parallel. But yeah, I don't know what's embarrassing about using the hardware available. So it's a little strangely coined. So let's call them inherently parallel. And that means that if we look at the example, so this is just very, very roughly sketched, right? So if we look at an architecture with 12 large cores, 48 medium cores, and 144 small cores, right? And they have relative performance. Say the large cores have a relative performance of 1, the medium of 0.5, and the small ones of 0.3, right? That means that theoretically we get a total throughput with the 12 large cores of 12, with the 48 medium cores of 24, and with 144 small cores, we get a total throughput time of 42 something. Okay. Geht's wieder? Okay?
Ja.
Gut. Super. Okay. So, right. So the idea is that we should be able to run multiple applications in parallel, right? And if we then look at our system performance, if we run just one application, right, the performance on the large core obviously is the best, right? And it starts decreasing once we go to the smallest core setting, right? However, if we add more and more applications that run in parallel, suddenly the small cores are better because they can run more stuff in parallel. Right, so that's essentially the message. Of course, if we have a rather large serial fraction, we don't gain as much as with a highly parallel workload. Right, so that's the message here. Okay. All right. So. The So the problem is that when we look at multi-core systems, is that the distribution of the frequency. That means also the distribution of the voltage to distribute the energy dissipation and actually shut off cores, turn off cores, or operate cores on lower frequencies. And so that means that we should be able to reduce the voltage in order to reduce the performance budget. However, that's not arbitrarily possible. That means that we can't just scale the different cores on our chip in any given manner. So what we see nowadays is that we can only scale the processors on a step by on some discrete steps, right? So if we look at if we look at what we have on some Intel CPUs is that we get various frequencies. So on this laptop here, we get we are able to set the frequency on this processor between 400 megahertz and 2.8 gigahertz, right? And currently it's automatically set to be 1.3 gigahertz, right? So this still suggests that we can increase the frequency arbitrarily on a hertz per hertz basis. However, if you look at if you look closer on the CPUs, you can I should have prepared it better. Sorry. There used to be a setting where you can print out the different frequency that are available, but I'm not seeing it right now. No, that's the maximum frequency and that's the minimum frequency. And there used to be, you can only set them at distinct values. Sorry about that. Okay, my bad. I forgot where to look that up. Anyways, you can only scale it fixed amount of different stages. That's the message. Okay, so the other problem is that the on-die networks and layouting, which is more or less related to that, The power consumption of those networks actually increases with the number of cores, right? So most of the time, we really don't have a direct connection between cores in a multi-core system because they implicitly communicate via a common cache, right? And the other possibility is really a point-to-point connection between the different cores. So the requirements of the future in order to get larger and larger core counts is to actually have a highly efficient on-chip network. But the problem here is that the different network links can be very power hungry, right? So this is an example for a four byte wide link and four links per core, right? And we already hit the 150 watt mark there. So this is something that's that needs some proper investigation there. And the on-chip networks, in my perspective, are the candidates with the highest chances of seeing architectural improvements in the sense that we that once the software developers learned how to properly utilize so many cores, the advancements in the on-chip networks is then what gives us back our free lunch, I think. Do you want me to repeat the vector instructions again? So I said this is from the old semester. Okay. Let's just skip. So how do we actually program multi-core? So one option to actually program multi-core systems is by using OpenMP. And OpenMP is a application programming interface for programming shared memory multiprocessors. It's coming with the help of compiler directives and a library with supporting functions. We can use OpenMP with Fortran, C, or C++. Okay, and idea here is that we have a shared memory model. That means that if we look at this block diagram here, all the processors communicate via some shared memory. So they synchronize and interact with common variables that all of the processors can access and look up in memory. Okay, so this is also what complicates the design for multi-core CPUs, right? Some of you mentioned the MACI protocol for caches. I don't remember who of you. Anyways. Yeah. So the main idea behind OpenMP is so-called fork join parallelism. That means that at the beginning of a process, we only have one master thread active. That's this line here, and this master thread executes some sequential code, right? And eventually the master thread forks and wakes up additional threads to execute parallel code, right? And then once the parallel region is finished, we join back to the master thread and continue with our serial portion of the code, right? So far, so good. And this, so this is also where you can see a direct relationship to Amdahl's law, right? The higher this serial fraction of our code gets, right, the less benefits we get when adding more and more cores, right? So imagine that we add more and more threads here, right? This window here gets smaller and smaller and smaller because we are able to divide the work to more processing elements, right? And this means that the serial fraction relative to the parallel fraction is getting larger and larger, which then limits the scalability. Right? Okay. So we don't only have shared memory models of parallel programming. We also have a message passing model, for example, with the message passing interface. That means that we have processes that communicate with each other, not via some shared memory region, but via explicit messages, right? Which has some advantages, some disadvantages. So the biggest advantage is, of course, that once we use the message passing model, it's way harder to actually introduce something like a race condition. If we have the shared memory model, it's incredibly easy to introduce race conditions, and it also puts more challenge onto the actual architecture to implement this shared memory model. Okay. So one of the goals of OpenMP is to allow for incremental parallelization. That means that we can use a step-by-step process to transform a serial program into a fully parallel program. Okay. What this means is that if we have an application, right? So let's say we have some application we have written for a single core, right? What we can do is we can identify some loops or whatever, which take lots of time, which are an easy target for parallelization. And we can use this to transfer from, to use the OpenMP pragmas to transform it from a serial program to a parallel program, right? Okay, so let's look at an example of how this parallelization works, right? So the easiest form, I think, of parallelization is data parallelism. And it's usually showing up in the form, so in C program, it's usually showing up in the form of some for loops, right? So in this case, we have the for loop going from some index to another given index, and we assign some value to some array, right? That means that theoretically we can execute this for loop in parallel because the access patterns are in such a way that we have no dependencies, and this can be executed in a data parallel way, right? And OpenMP uses a very simple mechanism to indicate that the iterations of one loop can actually be executed in parallel, and the compiler, the OpenMP compiler, generates code that automatically transforms the serial program into a parallel program to put the different loop iterations onto different threads by using this fork join mechanism, right? So, and this is done by those pragma compiler directives, right? This is some means to actually inform the compiler that we wanted to do something special, okay? And the nice thing about those pragmas is that even though you write this pragma and your compiler doesn't understand it, it's completely valid that it's being just ignored, right? Then you just don't have OpenMP. Right? Then you just don't get parallelization. And an example here is one of the easiest examples is that we have two arrays. We want to sum it up, right, and store it into a result array. And what we can do is we can just put pragma omp parallel 4 in front of it, and the compiler will parallelize this this loop for us. Okay, so very easy, I think. So far, so good. Okay. So we kind of have some restrictions on what loops we can actually parallelize with those pragmas, and the restrictions are that we can't allow early dropouts of the loop, so we can't have return statements or breaks or go-tos or any of those control statements. But we can have continue and exit within those, right? The other thing is that we have restrictions in the induction variables and the and the condition when the loop stops, right? So we can only have those smaller or smaller equal comparisons, and we only are allowed to have integer increments in this index here, right? So if you have anything more complex here, that won't work, right? So for example, index equals index times 20 or something like that, right? That's not going to work with OpenMP. The other thing with OpenMP is that each thread has its own execution context. And one execution context is an address space which contains all variables which a thread accesses. Okay. And the content of an execution context is essentially the static variables that are declared up front. Dynamically allocated data structures on the heap, variables on the stack, and additional stack produced for functions called by the thread, right? And in this execution context, we can put shared and private variables. So the shared variables have the same addresses over the execution context of each thread, and the private variables are really private to one of those execution contexts. So even though even if we access them concurrently over multiple threads, they have different addresses, and therefore the change of those variables don't affect the other threads. So we have a protected access across different threads. Okay. So what we have here is some common variables and specific private variables, right? So we have this pragma omp parallel 4. We execute from 0 to 2. So we have essentially two threads running, more or less. And each of those threads have one private I variable, right? The loop variable we loop over is always private, right? And then we have the three variables that are declared on the stack prior to the OpenMP execution. The three ones, right? And we also have access to the heap where the C pointer is pointing to, right? And we also have another variable I, which has a different address than the private variables in the actual parallel section. Is this clear to everyone?
No.
Okay. Okay, so remember that we operate on a in a shared memory environment, right? Sorry. So what we have in this example, what we do first is we declare three variables, right, on the stack, the B array, the C pointer, and the variable I. Right. So this is the master thread. Right. We then allocate something on the heap, right, with 1 byte. And then we start our parallel region, our parallel for loop. Right. And each of the threads that execute one of that is being executed for this loop gets its own execution context, right? And the execution context contains private variables, right? And the common variables that have been declared up front, which are then implicitly shared, right? So all those variables are shared. However, the variable I, which is being used by all the threads, needs to be private as well, right?
But then it could be that special executions are done by every parallelism or not, because if the I is for every for loop and not every shared memory node, what I is executed right now, then we can use that twice or
okay.
More.
Yeah. So what's happening is that so the question is if we have let's increase the number a little bit. So for I equals 0 to I smaller 10, right? And I plus plus, right? And then we do something. Okay. So the question is what's happening now, right? So if we distribute this among two cores, right? So say we have our pragma here, right? And we distribute it to two cores. Right? So we get our own I variable, so with the name. So each thread gets its own I, right? With the same name, same symbolic name. And what the compiler does is essentially it divides the iteration space into two chunks. So in that case, the first thread iterates from 0 to 5, right? And the second thread would then iterate from 5 to 10, right? So the communication of what part of the iteration space is being executed by which thread is being done upfront, right? So there's no communication required once the two threads have been started, right? They get assigned one specific chunk of work, right? So that's why those I's need to be private, right? If they would have been shared, right, we would need to have some kind of communication at after each iteration. When we increase I, right, they have to synchronize with each other so they know who increased it, or do I still need to increase it? What do I have to do next, etc. Right. So, and in this setting, when we divide the iteration space up front, the communication is completely eliminated. Okay. Right. So the next example would be that we have those nested for loops, okay? And theoretically, both of them can be parallelized, right? So we can put a pragma open OMP4 parallel for here and here, right? So the question really is, which one should we actually parallelize, right? And the question when doing this parallelization is always which one is actually more suitable, right? And a good measure for that is that the larger the grain size, that means the actual amount of work that needs to be done is, the better it is to parallelize, right? Because this fork join that we have here isn't free, right? Because we have to communicate with all the other processes. So there is a certain amount of overhead associated with that, right? That means that the parallel region actually, so the different tasks in here need to be long enough to actually amortize the costs of this fork and join, right? So in that sense, we should always choose, so in the context of the loop parallelization, we should always choose the loop with the larger grain sizes, right? So in that case, we would probably parallelize the outer loop, right? So we put the pragma OMP parallel 4 on the outer loop. The problem with that is if you always have if you always choose large grain sizes, right? If your iteration space, so let's assume that m is, for example, 10 or something like that, right? This is going to work out pretty nicely on a 2-core system, on a 4-core system, probably even on a 10-core system, right? But once you exceed the 10 cores, right, you have a problem, obviously, right? Because you don't have enough parallelism to actually feed into your processes. So choosing the right grain size for your given architecture is always a big challenge, right? And then, of course, each thread needs to have a private J variable here. All right. So this can be done with this specific directive here. Right. The other thing that you might want to make private in this context is also the temp variable, right? Because otherwise, the different threads would always access the same memory location, which. Yeah, no, it's not an error. It might be a performance optimization.
Okay. And the second question, why part is not private?
It's implicitly private because it's implicitly private because it's the loop we parallelize.
But we have initialized it outside.
Yeah.
Of
yeah.
So then it's global.
Yeah, but that's correct. But the rules say that the loop variable that directly comes after the pragma OMP parallel 4 is always implicitly private. Otherwise, it won't work, right? So if J would not be private, right, then everyone would arbitrarily set it to 0 and increase it. So this would be kind of a problem. Okay, so we have to set it to private, yeah?
So even if we have one more for loop, we need to put this iteration variable also private.
Yeah. So the simplest fix. So if you program in C, that's obviously a problem, right? So, so in C, the pattern that you see quite often is something like that, right? You have your you declare your loop variable up front, right, and then you do something, right? You usually don't see this form very often anymore, right? So what's more common nowadays is that you have something like this, right? Right? And with that, right, and if I put my pragma here, right, in with this formulation, the J is private as well because it's only declared within the scope of this parallel section, right? So it's kind of obsolete. Well, if you program it like this, then So the first form would have the problem, but the second form wouldn't, right? So I think with C 89, you were only allowed to declare the variables up front, right? But with C 99 or even 2011, you can also do it like that, right? So you could consider this as a kind of old style programming practice. Lots of C programmers actually do like to declare their variables up front, right? Because then they can immediately spot how big their stack's going to be. Right. Okay. Right. So the other thing is that we usually inherit the the value of a shared variable at the beginning of a thread, right? So if we declare a private variable, it inherits the value of the shared variable at the beginning of the thread, right? So in that case, what we have here is some variable x, which is a pointer, and we also update the variable x here in our computation, right? And we don't really want to. So the first private eventually says that it's going to be private. The value is only inherited the first time we access the variable. Okay, so it's a little convoluted. Yeah. So the counterpart is that the last iteration shall write back the value into the global variable. That means that we have that we can also say last private. That means that if we have this parallel section here, where we have last private x, right? The last one to write in the into the variable x, then also pushes the the value to the shared variable, right? So that we are able to parallelize this thing here. Okay, is this clear to everyone? So first private, the first time we touch the variable, we will get the value into our execution context. And last private means that the last one who accesses this this variable actually propagates it back to the global variable. Right. Okay. So I expected a little more questions. Do you still have questions? No. Okay. Okay. That's more or less all for today. Next time we will talk about specific CPU architectures. Okay, we will start with Intel architectures. Okay?